Welcome to Unity 101, Chris. Thanks very much for joining us.
No, it's a pleasure.
Really appreciate you joining us today to talk about environmental issues in the winter.
Yeah, no, I like to do things close to home. I'm a Southampton boy, so you know, to come and do something here in my own community is something I'm quite passionate about. So it's a real pleasure.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, so yeah, thanks for joining us. And people probably know you originally from the Really Wild Show, which I understand you were in from about 1985 to 1995.
Yeah, well, you've done some homework, which is good, because I'm not very good at remembering my own chronological events, really, just about my date of birth. I do remember starting the Really Wild Show in the mid-80s, yeah. Not something that I'd planned to do. TV wasn't a career choice that I was even thinking about, to be quite honest with you. In fact, I didn't really have much of a career at the time. I was going to stay in the academic system, which is what I'd been planning to do from about the age of 13 onwards. But I got quite frustrated by the fact that most of my superiors in the department, if you like, spent a lot of time sat in their office filling in forms, trying to get studentships and grants, and that wasn't me. I'm a furiously impatient person, and I just wanted to get in the field and uncover you know, new things, satisfy my curiosity and get working. And I had a fear hanging over me that was going to be the case. So although I was set to do a PhD continuing my study of badgers, which was a local thing, I didn't, and I was walking down the road in Bitton, in Southampton, and I met a man there who couldn't park a car. He kept trying to reverse it onto the pavement in front of a bus stop, and the old ladies were all complaining. And when he got out, I said to him, "Before you next get out and into your car, why don't you pass your driving test?" And he immediately, I'm quite a confrontational person, I have to say, and he immediately launched into me. We had a furious argument on the pavement in front of this audience of very, very well-presented old ladies. And a couple of weeks later, I met him for the second time, and we just picked up where we left off.
There was just sort of, by coincidence.
Purely by coincidence. And it turned out that he was a wildlife cameraman working for the Natural History Unit in Bristol, making an Attenborough series at the time. And in a sort of a trade-off of, like, I was full-on punk rock at the time, you know. I mean, it was like blue hair, leather jacket.
I think I remember the blonde, spiky hair,
And he sort of had some sort of throwaway comment of, you know, "Why don't you smarten yourself up and get a job," which was obviously fuel to my fire. But the upshot of this whole event was that at 5 a.m. the next morning, I turned up at his house to feed his orphaned bats.
Right.
And I think his test was, you know, if anyone can come to my house and feed 30 orphaned pipistrelles from a bottle, or pipette as it was, then they might pass the test. And I worked with him without ever another argument for 3 years. Yeah, and we are both two of the most argumentative fellows. For 3 years as a camera assistant. And it was only after that that I'd... you know, when you start, obviously, as a cameraman, you don't get given all the best jobs. You have to build up a skill base that other people recognise.
Yeah.
And so I was in and out of employment doing that, and it was then that I went and chased myself a job down on the Really Wild Show. And I remember speaking to my sister walking across Hoglands Park in Southampton on the way to HMV to buy some more punk rock. And she said to me, "I think you'd be good at it, Chris." She said, "I think you'd be good at it. You're such an enthusiast. You've bored us all for years talking about animals." And that was my qualification, really. I suppose the fact that I have an enthusiasm, which is lifelong, a curiosity, which appears to be lifelong. And and I've always been keen to talk to people about the things that I'm most passionate about, principally, I suppose, well, professionally at least, it's wildlife. So that's how it all started. It wasn't a plan at all, you know. Yeah. It was entirely... And at first I was really uncomfortable with the presenting. I'm not a TV presenter. Well, I am, but I mean, I'm just not the typical TV presenter. And I found the whole thing a little bit uncomfortable, and I still do. I still get very embarrassed and very sort of... a bit reticent to accept that, you know, just because I'm on TV doesn't mean there's anything big and clever about me. That's it, basically. I'm just what I am. I enthuse about wildlife and various other things. I've learned my skill and my trade, I suppose. I try to do it as professionally as possible. But, you know, it's a job like any other.
So was the camera assistant you heard about an audition coming up for the Really Wild
Show?
Well,
I'd already missed the auditions, but as I said, you know, punk rock was very much about kicking down doors and making them open for yourself. So I literally got on the train and went to Bristol, and I didn't demand that they give me the job. I'm not quite, you know, I'm not like that. But eventually, having done the audition, the producer, who was a fantastic chap, and I'm eternally grateful for not only the Really Wild Show, but many other things that he, opportunities that he created for me over the years, Mike Bainan was his name, And anyway, he was dillying and dallying, and I phoned him up, and he was going, oh, don't know, we haven't made up our mind. And it got to the crux of it, and I thought, right. So I got on the train for the second time. I went to Bristol, walked into the office, which I was able to do because I was working as a cameraman there, and I stood in front of his desk, you know, dripping studs and leather. And I said to him, listen, I said, you're messing around with my life here. You either want me to do this or you don't. So make a decision in the next 10 seconds. And he said, really? Based upon that, you've got the job.
Fantastic.
Excellent.
It was, you know, that whole ethos of go and do it for yourself. And I am a do-it-yourselfer. It doesn't matter what it is. If no one else is doing it, then, you know, I'll try and do it. And that's why, you know, I think that... that helps as an environmentalist conservationist. One of my messages to people is do it yourself. Don't think that everything can be done by everyone else. There are a lot of committed people out there, but resources are always and will always be limited.
Yes.
So please, you know, get going. If you've got an agenda, don't wait for someone else to do it. Do it yourself.
Yeah.
I think that's a really strong message. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, thanks. And so what were your sort of favourite moments from the Really Wild show? You had a number of different things to do on the show.
Purely selfishly, it was, I'm the luckiest bloke on earth. I've got, for me, probably the only job that I could do. I'm not immensely employable, given my disposition and other things. But I'm extremely fortunate. And what it's meant is that I've continued to learn about wildlife all of my life. Yesterday I was out with a fellow called Graham Roberts, who I've known since I was a teenager. He studies otters, you know, all over the country, principally here in Hampshire, and I learned a lot more about otters yesterday. I spent a lot of time in his company, thankfully, over the years. I've seen lots of otters, I've been bitten by otters, I've fed otters, I've smelled their poo, you know. But when you meet with someone like that through the purposes of TV, you just learn more, and that's what excites me getting up. So Really Wild Show, honestly, I went into the studio the first day and someone walked in with a cheetah and I played football with it. I mean, you know, it was just unbelievable. The only thing that scared me were the kids and
not the animals.
I've grown up with animals, but I obviously didn't have any kids of my own at that time, and I was really worried about how the kids would take me, really. But it seemed to work, and I mean, I've never treated kids any different than adults. I never patronise them. I speak to them as adults with a smaller vocabulary, and that's about it, really. And so it worked out all round. And then, of course, opportunities to travel followed from that. And this University of Television, which I've been attending for the last 15, 20 years, has given me scope to see all sorts of things. But yeah, purely selfishly speaking, it's the fact that I've been able to walk into a lab, a nature reserve, whatever, meet an acknowledged expert and say to them, what do you know? And they will tell you without resentment. And that's fantastic. Fantastic.
Mm. Yeah.
Best bit of my job.
Excellent. So have you had any sort of embarrassing moments on the Really Wild Show?
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, embarrassing to most people is sort of farting and pooing, and the animals do that with astounding regularity and never in the right place. And of course, those early Really Wild Shows were studio-based, and we had animals come into the studio with a live audience of kids as well, so everything was going, you know, wrong. And so we always got pooed upon, or there was a big loud sort of raspberry from the corner, and an elephant smiled, and things like that. So that was always there. But in terms of... we also had quite a lot of dangerous animals into the studio, and I remember we'd have to go through all sorts of hoops to make sure that we could do that safely. And so if crocodiles or poisonous snakes came in, they would come in tanks that they couldn't possibly get out of, and so on and so forth. But one researcher we had working on the programme on one occasion set up an item about rabbits. Now, rabbits obviously have the reputation for doing, you know, two things. One is looking cute and cuddly and making great pets. The other is breeding, you know, profusely. But of course, they also have other sides to their characters, which they didn't research. So, in fact, more young people were injured, bitten, scratched, clothes destroyed in an item with 30 rabbits than they were with all of the crocodiles, all the venomous snakes, all of the lions, all of the tigers, everything.
Yeah.
Well, we had them on this plinth of grass, and of course the other thing that rabbits do is they fight, you know, they fight and they kick. And of course the minute these bucks were put on there with the does, it turned into, it was like a gladiatorial rabbit coliseum. It was just a mess of rabbit fur. And the kids were holding some of them and they got bitten and scratched, their clothes got destroyed. So yes, paradoxically, for all of the danger, the only really serious destruction was wrought by rabbits.
A few cuddly rabbits.
I don't know, apart from that, you know, I never get worried about messing up, you know, it's one of those things. I used to get butterflies before I used to run, you know, athletics. I used to get really pretty uptight before racing. But TV, I've never... Even live stuff, I think the thing is, you know, as we're speaking now, we make mistakes, we're having a conversation. So if it's live, that makes it real. And if you have to correct yourself, I just said dumb. No, that's not written down in any script, you know. So and I kind of like that naturalistic. I've always liked that. And the broadcasters that I liked, and you know, then and now, are those that do it that way. So I've never been uptight about it. And these days, of course, most of the things that I do some live things. Most of the things I do are recorded. And that doesn't mean you just go on and on. You still try and get it in take one, because otherwise you're wasting everyone's time. So, you know, but at the same time, I try to do it with all of these inflections, which I'm now very conscious that I'm using in this conversation.
So you've got a lot of passion and enthusiasm for wildlife, and that's great. Have you got any particular favourite animals that you could... name? Or
I mean, I like things that fly. I don't know, when I was sort of Peter Pan kid or whatever it was, but flying things, birds, any flying insects, they really get my, you know, get me going. Dragonflies. I like predators. I've never been a bunny hugger. But, you know, rabbits for me, voles, they're there as, you know, units to be eaten by something slightly more interesting. So I've always been a fan of predators. Like most kids, I liked big, fierce animals. Best animal ever on Earth, T-Rex. Haven't seen one, never will. But, I mean, you know, it stands, you know, shoulders above the rest as probably being the most exciting thing that ever trod the planet. And I think one of the reasons why it's exciting is that we will never see it. So we've all got our own private T-Rex, we imagine it. I like to chase birds around, and I say that without it being a sort of a Benny Hill pun. And flying insects, I like dragonflies a lot, wasps, hornets, butterflies. Yeah, flight gets me going. I think I like animals also that have extreme adaptations to their environment. So I like creatures that live in the extreme cold or hostile environments, or parasites that live, you know, in us. And evolution has sculpted their life histories and their lifestyles to the extreme, and therefore they are, I find them, you know, more interesting, I suppose. Yeah, that's what it is.
To see their adaptations to the different environments.
Generalists, herbivores, no. Guinea pigs, no.
Okay. So what sort of things have you been doing related to the environment since the Really Wild show? I know you've done a number of shows.
Lots of other programs with wild in the title, actually. Someone asked me for a biography recently, and I sort of very, you know, coyly sat down to write one out. And I noticed that most of the programs that I've ever been involved in have got wild in the title, which is good, I suppose, to some extent. But not showing a lot of imagination in some of the producers. I've done lots, really, all over the world. Lots of live programs. Worked for National Geographic in the United States. That was interesting. And most recently, I've done a couple of series. One was called Hands on Nature. It was BBC Two. The one that's we've finished recording, the first 10 programs have already gone out. It's called Nature's Calendar. Again, that's BBC Two. Next batch go out after Christmas. It is after Christmas. Okay, shows you I'm not on the planet. they go out in the spring. And there were 40 half hours. They're very much almost a British wildlife holiday program. You know, where you can go, this is the public access to every site, where you can go in the UK to see wildlife close up, and a few tips on where it is, how to get there, and what to do to get close to these animals. And the general ethos of the series was that many people, I think, watch TV and they think that the things they see are the preserve of scientists, lifelong naturalists, experts of some kind. But in fact, of course, there are many things you could see within meters of where we are now, certainly miles, which would excite people if they know a little bit more about the natural history, and they are definitely accessible. I'm very keen to put people in contact with wildlife. I think that we stand in danger of losing a new generation of young naturalists because they're not allowed to roam the countryside as I was, because they come home from school and they sit in front of a computer where there's lots of information, but they never get stung, scratched, pooed on, and all of those essential things which develop a real affinity for the subject. And that really worries me, because obviously once you get that, once you're infected with that interest, and most naturalists we know catch the bug before the age of 9. So if young people under 9 don't get out and feel newts on the palm of their hand, don't have grass snakes produce that, interesting secretion from their anal glands that dribbles down your arm, that you smell under the bed covers when your mum's told you to wash your hands, but you don't because you love the smell of grass snake.
Talking from experience here, Chris?
Yeah. Yeah. I still like the smell of grass snake now. Once you've got it, you keep it. But if we don't have young people, then who's going to come through? It will be people who learn their trade in the pixelated library of the computer screen. And that will be terrible, because I don't think they'll really have the depth of longing to continue their interest. So yeah, I'm really keen to put people of all ages into contact firsthand. One of my maxims I always rant on about is, you know, wildlife TV is great to instigate an interest, but it's by no means a way of satisfying an interest. You've got to see it for yourself.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah,
it sounds like these programs, because they are places that people can go to, sounds like they should hopefully do the trick and get people a bit
well,
more
well, it's working
involved.
Our first series went out and we've had people who've sent us photographs saying, you know, we watched it, yes, we went, look at our photographs, and we've had lots of really positive emails.
Oh,
which is
great.
Nice to get that feedback. Even one or two is enough to satisfy me. I feel job done, you know, if I get one email, meet someone in the street and they say, oh, we saw that and we went there and we had a great day, and you think, mission accomplished, really, you know. So yes, the first series has gone out, we've got three more blocks of 10 to go in this year.
I think I'll be watching it.
Yeah,
Major's
yeah,
calendar, we'll tune in too. Yeah. Normally 7 o'clock or so. I don't watch it, obviously. Once it's done for me.
No, that's great. Right.
Do you have any other programmes in the pipeline for the future? Or?
Yeah, well, I was hoping actually on the 8th of January to have a series rubber stamped, which hasn't happened. That's another UK-based series. I'm trying not to travel too much overseas. Have been maintaining that sort of objective for the last few years on account of small child. So that's another UK-based series, much closer to home, looking at wildlife in people's communities. So I'm very keen on that for the reasons I've just outlined. I'm doing another local programme called Inside Out, which starts tomorrow, yeah. And that's a regional magazine program with all sorts of things in, bit of natural history, bit of heritage, bit of scoundrels, a few scoundrels, and things like that. And that's good fun to do. It's going to sort of something fresh every day.
Yeah, excellent. So yeah, one of the Environment Agency's core themes is a better environment for wildlife, and thinking locally about Hampshire, yeah, you've mentioned a few of these sort of opportunities that the community has to go out into the local nature reserves. And what sort of species do you think people can expect to see in this winter in their gardens or local nature reserves, or just when going out for a walk?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we have a coastline, which is incredibly important in the winter. It, you know, we have a number of sites spattered around that coastline, which are internationally important for birds, obviously. Winter, whether you like it or not, is quite a birdy time. We have a relatively small mammal fauna, not many species. Some hibernate, not many these days. Well, all of the bats, of course, and they represent quite a significant proportion of that fauna. But it's a birdy time of year, not many insects about, obviously, and plants are not blooming, so people are not so keen to chase after them. Fungi have largely finished. So it's a birdy time of year, and we get vast numbers of wading birds and wildfowl that come down to the coast. So certainly a trip to, you know, anywhere along the coast, really, Beauly Estuary around Lymington with Pennington down there, or on the other side you've got Farlington Marshes and Hayling Island, any of those inlets. Titchfield Haven, of course, fantastic local reserve. And if you go at this time of year, you're sure to see large numbers of waders that have come down to escape the harsher climes further north. Personal highlights, Farlington on a crisp spring morning, blue sky, loads of Brent geese reeling around against the backdrop of urban Portsmouth. You get this stark contrast of something which has come from a wilderness at the top of the planet and is now flying around Portsmouth, which is sort of urban sprawl, you know, like so many of our other cities. So I like that. And of course, we also get winter visitors that come to our gardens. So the place is stiff with redwing and field fare at the moment. I've had them coming to my garden. And all of the birds which you should be feeding, because, you know, all of our resident species, you know, of tits and finches need food in the wintertime to pack up their body reserves ready for the spring.
Yeah, because we wanted to ask, what can the community do to help these species in the winter?
Well, I mean, I think going back to the very beginning of our interview, the do-it-yourself ethos is, you know, you can make a difference. This is very important. You've got to think that no matter how small or modest your patch, whether it's a window box or a square of gravel, you can make a difference when it comes to specifically initially wildlife. So feeding birds is one of the easiest things to do. If you've got a lot of birds, it becomes expensive, but it does make a difference. There are certain species in this country. We hear all too often about animals, birds that are in decline, But there are many species in the ascendancy, and some of these, it can be directly attributed to people feeding them in their gardens and providing nesting resources, putting up boxes. So you can make a difference in your garden. In my last garden, I put up 18 boxes. It wasn't a big garden, but everything, every available space had a box on it, even one on the side of the car. And it didn't get used, luckily. in the best year, 9 out of those 18 boxes were used. And that means that, you know, we provided a resource for 9 families of birds that previously wasn't there. So feed the birds. Also, water is really important for those. But also think about other creatures and extend the hand of tolerance, because all too often in cities, people, we have these prejudices which say that things like rats and cockroaches and ants, and I could go on, there seem to be so many pests listed in people's agendas. But really, these are species which are tenacious enough to live alongside us. So we should take our hats off to them and learn to live with them, not exterminate them because we're in fear of them. It's easy to live with these creatures without any risk of infection or anything. If we understand their ecology, you can live alongside them easily.
Yeah, great. So are you aware of any local environmental problems in Hampshire and Isle of Wight that are a particular concern to you? Is there any?
Well, sadly, lots.
Yeah.
I mean, the good thing about the south of England is it's got some fantastic habitat: downland, heathland, New Forest, ancient woodland, coastline, as I've already said. But it's got a lot of pressures. There's a huge number of people living here. And they spread into all sorts of different areas, really. I mean, there's direct pressure on the environment through building for new housing. There's all sorts of pressures on the environment which come from intensive farming. Although I have to say, you know, I am incredibly in sympathy with the rural economy at the moment. I don't think that we can ask the rural economy and the people who work there, the farmers, I suppose, principally, to look after wildlife as much as we'd like, and until we look after them, and they're not getting looked after. We've got to look after our farmers and the way they behave far more. So I'm very keen to build bridges and partnerships which will help the rural economy. That's important. We've got water issues, and I'm pleased to say, despite the fact that I'm here dripping, that, you know, this is the wettest winter for some time, and water has been a really important issue in the south of England. You know, I'm a keen supporter of the Water Festival, which is on in July this year. We'll be in Andover. Try and get along. It's great fun. It's a fun day out. A lot of local businesses attend, and it's a good way of raising water onto everyone's agenda. But the aquifers are filling, which is great news. The rivers were rushing yesterday when I was out. I was actually out yesterday. I'm chasing after otters, which is a gentleman I know collects the DNA, trying to establish the population of otters in Hampshire. And it's an Environment Agency funded project. Thank you very much.
No problem.
Because it's a brilliant project. It's cutting edge science. It's not too expensive, but it's great to see the agency funding a project like that, because it's telling us definitively how many animals we've got here. And it's very difficult to count otters, because you don't get to see them. You just get to see their poo, which is just as exciting if you're weird.
So they can take the DNA from the otter poo.
And they identify them down to individuals.
And
the science is improving all the time. So keep funding that project, please, because in a few years' time, we'll have a much better idea of the definitive population. But it's a fantastic project, and it's one of the things I like about the agency. It's a very broad agenda that it has, and I get to see lots of environment agency projects, and they have a really broad spread, and some of them are really good. There's a great project running up at the moment just the other side of Slough, in the Thames Basin there, where the whole landscape is being, you know, re-sculptured in terms of its floodplain. It's all environment agency stuff with other partners, but principal drivers. And although it's looking pretty raw at the moment because it's new, the landscape's looking pretty raw, it's going to be fantastic in the future. So that's really good thinking ahead. We know we've got water problems ahead, paucity of it, too much of it, could be sea level, could be coming up, but dealing with it now, building a framework now to reduce problems in the future, is intelligent. So that's bound to get my support.
So you've mentioned the Hampshire Water Festival coming up in July. Are there any other local events coming up that you're aware of, or projects that the community can get involved in?
Yeah, plenty. I mean, I think the first thing to do is you should, if you're into wildlife, there's the Hampshire Wildlife Trust. I mean, they organise walks and talks and everything throughout the year, many during the course of a month. This is your county. This is where you can get out and relatively easily enjoy wildlife yourself. It's much better than on TV. So get in touch with the Hampshire Wildlife Trust. Sign up. They need your money, but they need more than that. They need your support. And if you're interested, get along to these talks and walks, because they'll be hosted by experts and you will learn a lot. And that's well, that's what I've already, you know, that's what I say, that's the best bit. And they've also got a fine network of reserves. Closer to home, there's the Southampton Natural History Society. And again, I've been 45 years old, I've been going since I was a lad. And they, again, much more locally organise a string of events, and within the boundaries of the city, and the city here is fantastically resourced for, you know, for green sites. Believe it or not, tucked behind all these houses are some excellent areas to explore. And again, it's staffed with some experts on moths and butterflies and everything else. So that's the wildlife side. I think the other side is that there's a sustainable development partnerships, all sorts of things going on in Southampton. They are accessible, whether it's on the web or you walk into the office. And it comes back to the thinking of the bigger picture. It's all very well conserving wildlife in Hampshire, but you know, if we continue to pump CO2 into the atmosphere, it's all going to be under the sea anyway. So yeah, you've got to work on a bigger agenda. Yes, yeah, feed the birds in your garden. Yes, be concerned about the water in your county. But at the same time, you've got to be thinking about how you can reduce your impact on the global environment. Because one thing I've definitely learned in the course of my travels is that the world is a very small place under a lot of pressure. So energy-saving light bulbs, flushing, you know, not so much toilet waste. Everything you can possibly do will make a difference. Don't think that you're some imperceptible little cell and that, you know, whatever you do is going to be crushed by the likes of the lunatic George Bush and his men. Because, you know, if enough people refuse to kneel before that sort of apathy and they actually do something, then we can all make a difference.
Well, thanks for that, Chris. That's definitely a message that the Environment Agency would support, I think, and that's absolutely the kind of message that we'd like to put out to the community. And just to say thanks very much for coming
along.
It's
a pleasure.
It's been great to get your views on environmental issues in the winter. But before you go, I think my colleague Judith has got one final question for you.
Go on.
Yes, it's quite an easy one, Chris. Have you got any environmental New Year's resolutions?
I'm glad you said environmental New Year's resolutions. Some of my other non-environmental ones probably wouldn't be best broadcast. I suppose I have, but it's only really the one that I make every year, and that is that, you know, I have to do it on a yearly basis. What I try and strive to do is to try and find some new way of doing, you know, something for myself, a bit where I can make a difference. Now, in the past, it was easy because I'd just say, right, I'm going to recycle all of my glass. This is going back years. I'm going to recycle all of my paper. And, you know, and you'd come up with these things that, yes, you can do. Of course, the more things you do, the more difficult it gets to find something that you can easily integrate into your life that you can make a change with. So, you know, that's for me what it's all about. It's about doing it for yourself. I'm very reluctant to allow, with respect, the Environment Agency or charities, RSPB, Wildlife Trust, whatever it happens to be, you know, I don't think that they can do it all. I think that I can play a role. So when it comes to the greater environment, and I think this is as of equal importance as to anything else, then yes, I'm going to do that. So I tell you what I'm going to do, and I have made up my mind. I haven't done it yet. And where are we? Is it the 10th or 11th? Or I don't know what it is.
January.
I've got to get to the shops. Energy saving light bulbs. When they came out, I really didn't like them because they were too dim. I'm a bright light person. I need 150, 200 watts per room. Yes. They've greatly improved in quality. The price has come right down. And I've determined that although half my house has got energy saving, I'm going to get energy saving bulbs for the rest of the house.
That's fantastic. Thank you, and hopefully that'll be an example that others can follow. So, well, obviously, thanks very much for coming along.
Pleasure.
And good luck with all your future programmes, including Nature's Calendar, which will be on very shortly.
Indeed.
Great. Thanks very much, Chris.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.